Is there life on Mars? This is an age-old question, and we are getting really close to being able to find the answer. There are spacecraft right now on Mars searching for evidence that there was water for long periods of time, that the conditions for life were there. But next come the missions that are going to search for life. But there's a bit of a time crunch, and that's because humans are potentially going to be going to Mars, and humans are filthy, and they are covered in bacteria. One of the big risks is that we go to Mars, and all we find is Earth-based cyanobacteria that had moved quickly and colonized the whole place. So we've got this window to search for life on Mars before Earth life tries to take over. And so my guest today is Dr. Jan Szpaczek. He is a senior research scientist at the Foundation for Applied Molecular Evolution, and he is the winner of a NASA NIAC grant for the Agnostic Life Finder. This is a mission, a gadget, that would be attached to any process on Mars that's attempting to extract water. So imagine if a rocket is trying to refuel itself using water, it's going to break it up into hydrogen and oxygen or make methane on the surface of Mars. This taps into the water supply and tries to screen out organic molecules, DNA, things that could give you evidence that there is life on Mars. And if so, then you can do a more deeper search. So we talk a lot about what the Agnostic Life Finder will be, how it's going to work, how it could be deployed, but Jan has his hands in a lot of projects. He's working on the upcoming Morningstar mission to Venus. This is that mission, that the privately funded mission that's going to be searching for evidence of life in the cloud tops of Venus, living in the sulfuric acid. He's working on another mission called Inspire that could potentially send thousands of impactor probes to Mars, very on the cheap, to try and get a lot of experiments going at the same time. So we have a really interesting wide-ranging conversation about both his NIAC project, but all of his other projects and ways that you can get involved. So enjoy this interview with Dr. Jan Szpaczek. Jan, first, congratulations on winning one of the 2024 NASA NIAC grants. So describe your proposal to NASA. What's the plan?
Okay, thank you. So the plan is to seek extant life on Mars before we send humans there. The idea is that before we send humans to Mars, we will be mining Martian water. It's called ISRU, in situ research utilization, to produce propellant and to have a consumable for future astronauts. So I thought about it and thought that this could be actually astrobiological sample. We can take this water and extract biopolymers from this. And that's the instrument we are building. That's ALF, as you said, ALF.
What does that stand for?
That stands for Agnostic Life Finder.
Right. But it's a backronym, right? Like, right. It's a reference to the TV show?
Behind me.
Oh, right. There he is. Okay. Yeah. I was wondering. So, podcast listeners, he's pointing to the puppet.
It became as an acronym and then became a sort of, as you said, background.
Yeah.
Right. So it's either Agnostic Life Finder or Alien Life Finder because, you know, we are looking for aliens living now on Mars, hopefully. The idea is to use electrodialysis. Going even further back, idea is that all life has to have some genetic polymers in them that enable the evolution. So instead of seeking biosignatures, which are products of life, like methane or some shapes, we can search for molecules that enable evolution. So instead of searching for those unreliable biosignatures, we aim to look for, polyelectrolytes. And the idea behind this, that's actually from Stephen Banner, who is PI on this NIAC proposal. It's called Polyelectrolyte Theory of a Gene. And the idea is that all genetic polymers needs to be multiply charged to prevent the long molecules which carry the information from crumbling on themselves, just like proteins do, into globular shapes. So that's okay. The idea.
So DNA is charged in a way that essentially it repels itself so that it doesn't just fold itself up into a little ball. And that by searching for that charge, those charged particles in water samples, you're hoping to get evidence of some kind of life there?
Right. So yeah, you summarized it well. So if we search for molecules that are long polymers, which have multiple charges, it's quite unlikely that they would be produced abiotically. So if we find something like that, we can say that we found life with high probability. And that's why it's agnostic, Life Finder, because we are not searching just for DNA. We are searching for all kinds of polyelectrolytes.
And so if you take water here on Earth and you run it through this kind of an experiment, will you get any false positives, or is everything that is detected as a charged long polymer some either life itself or some side effect of life?
Right. So before we run the water through, we need to sonicate it, treat it with ultrasound to disrupt the cells, because DNA is usually, most of the DNA in oceans is enclosed actually in the bacterial cells. So we need to disrupt them first. And once they are in the streams, we can pull them out. And we haven't tested yet, but the assumption is that there would not be false positives. The aim of the NIAC proposal is to actually test it on core samples from Antarctica later this year. So we will see what might be false positive would be like silica particles, which have a specific size and charge. But so they would be captured in the same channel as a DNA, for example. But subsequent analysis of them would tell us whether it's a long polymer or whether it's a small particle. So, and the membranes which separate those channels from the stream of liquid to the captured channels will be selected. So we will reject vast majority of these particles.
Right. Well, yeah, and you're sort of going into my next question here in bits and pieces. So explain how you think this process is going to work. You know, you have a tube, you suck up some water, okay, or you melt some water, or however you get some water into your device. What is the pathway? What is actually happening inside the device to
begin this process? I'm hoping, we are relying on somebody else doing the hard part, which is actually mine, the Martian water. Yeah. So we have Honeybee Robotics, for example. They have a Red Belt project where they are designing mining of a Martian water. They will make a rod well, which is you make a borehole, then you pump hot water in and suck up the melted water along with the Martian water. Or SpaceX on their official webpage have a note that they will use local Martian water to refuel starships. To refuel starships, you need to mine hundreds of tons of Martian water to get enough hydrogen to reduce the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So ALF, our instrument, would sit on that stream of melted water, which would likely be from mid-latitude subsurface ice, which we assume, based on our latest research data, that it's a massive ice, basically from 40 degrees north towards the poles on Mars. So that's, the assumption is that both Mars life and life humans that are going to Mars require water. And so we can merge these two ideas together. ALF will be hitchhiking on these types of missions. Whoever mines water, we can provide it for them.
Right. So whoever, there's going to be plenty of reasons to grab water from from Mars for living on Mars, for creating rocket fuel, all that kind of stuff. And so you can just tap into the flow of water and start sampling it for life.
Correct.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. All right. And so then don't worry about that pesky engineering problem of getting the water. All you have to think about is analyzing the water. So what is happening inside your experiment?
Okay. So then, we assume that the melted water will be full of particulates because it's basically permafrost on Mars. There will be dust, there will be clay particulates, and it will contain quite a bit of salt. We are not sure how much salt will be there. It depends on how the subsurface ice was deposited and perhaps even how lucky you are with your rod well. If you tap into a site which has more salts, you will have more salts. So this melted water with the particulates will be passed through our instrument. The point is that we don't have any filters perpendicular to the flow of the water. We have filters on sides, which means that the large particulates can pass straight through to along with a main body of water, which will be processed further as the rocket company wishes. Upstream from that, in our instrument, we will have a section which is in electric field between two electrodes. And so towards the anode, which is positively charged electrode, we'll move our polyelectrolytes, like DNA. Towards the cathode, we'll move perhaps alien genetic polymers or some proteins. And that's how we... So that's the central channel from these two channels is separated by microfiltration membrane, which has a pore size about 0.1 micron. We'll do better selection based on a clay particle distribution we expect to be in a Mars regolith or on-site. And what prevents the DNA to migrating further towards electrodes. It's another set of membranes which have pores small enough to not let larger organic molecules to pass through, but still large enough to pass ions to allow to sustain the electric field. That's what we need. And then right. We have one more set of membranes, which is too much details, but
right. But okay, so if the process works as you're hoping, then by having these various, the anode and the cathode, you got the anode, you are pulling these organic molecules into a place, a chamber, a collection bucket. How are you then going to try to analyze these molecules?
Right. So we are proposing to use nanopores, either for screening for DNA, biological nanopores like MinION would be ideal because we already have pre-concentrated, desalted sample of DNA which passed through the screen. A more agnostic approach is to use mineral pore nanopores, which are, again, nanopore sequencing technique where you are pulling the polymer through a pore, and as it passes through, you are analyzing conductivity through the pore, and that will tell you about the approximate shape of the molecule you are pulling through.
Oh, that's really interesting. So sorry, let me just stop you here. So you're taking this molecule, you're pulling it through a pore that's only like a little bigger than the molecule itself. And as the molecule is coming through the pore, you are analyzing the electric charge on all of the atoms in the molecule, and that's giving you a sense of how complicated the molecule is?
Well, you almost got it. Instead of analyzing the charge on the molecule, you are analyzing resistance across the pore. So if you put the molecule in the pore as it's coming through, it's basically increasing the resistance in the channel. So you can see the decreased current over time. And based on the time of transition, you can estimate the length of the molecule. And based on how deep the reduction of current is, you can estimate how thick the molecule is. So if you have something like DNA, you will right. see nice like shape in the time current curve, which indicates that it's long molecule with consistent with thickness. If it's some inconsistent molecule, you will see like more rough profile.
Wow. And is this like this technology used today? Like if you take DNA, put it through these micropores, measure the conductivity, you can say, oh, a chunk of DNA just passed through the pore.
Actually, the MinION nanopores, which they are already used for sequencing. So they are quite good enough to analyze metagenome of any field sample. Or actually, it was used on ISS as well to analyze the bacterial loads they have there.
Right. So you're not necessarily going to be getting the, you know, you're not going to be doing the actual scan of the DNA. You're not going to know the C's and the T's and the A's and the G's, but you are going to know, okay, a molecule that is roughly this many atoms long just passed through the pore or with a profile of this big. And there are very few molecules that are going to match those kinds of profiles.
Right. Yeah. So there are two kinds of pores, right? You have the biological nanopore, which can do the sequencing, and we can actually try to apply that as well. But the mineral nanopore is just a hole in a membrane, which will not tell you the sequence of the DNA. But from the observed data, we can make educated guesses what just passed through that pore. So these are two instruments we are proposing, as well as mass spectrometry. But our part of the work is to just develop the concentrator to pull those polyelectrolytes out, and then we will pass it on to other teams to design those.
So once again, someone else's problem.
We will put them all together, but at the current phase, we are making sure that we can actually pull the DNA from the stream.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I like this idea that you're taking this water, concentrating it down, trying to pull the most interesting, most lifelike molecules out of it. Now, obviously, whenever we talk about the search for life, we are saying this is life as we know it, that this is some kind of life that maybe uses DNA, that uses water as a solvent, and so on and so forth. Do you think there are characteristics that are sort of more generalizable, like for life, that maybe could pick up life as we don't know it?
Right. That's what I tried to mention in the beginning, because it's called agnostic life finder. The assumption is that different kind of life could have different genetic polymers. We already know it that on Earth, we have some bacteriophages that instead of adenine in their DNA, they are using aminoadenine. And they were escaping our metagenomic searches for a long time because when you run PCR, you are using, you are not accounting for that. So DNA, which contains regular DNA, regular adenine, basically overcomes that signal. So if Martians contain DNA, like molecule, which is very similar to DNA, but some of the bases are a little bit different, we would not be able to find them with, for example, PCR technology. We want to use different techniques that don't rely on enzymatic amplification. So that's what we are using. Another reason why we prefer larger samples is we expect that life on Mars will be very sparse from Earth analogs on we study here in Atacama Desert. We know that actually no instrument on Mars right now would be able to detect organics in a sparse soil environment where you have a redstone in Atacama Desert, which is analogical to sediments. We are now collecting samples from the Jezero crater with Perseverance. So when you have larger samples and doing the pre-concentrations from liters instead of milliliters, you ensure that you have much better chance of actually finding something. And yes, even if you have very sensitive technique, but you are sampling just 1 milliliter and you have concentration of bacteria less than 1 bacteria per milliliter, you would miss that, right? So larger sample is always better when you are looking for sparse life.
It's interesting, you know, there's this idea of the shadow biosphere on Earth, that there could be other life that we just don't see because, as you said, you know, the PCR methodology is designed to look for exactly DNA. And so if it's not exactly DNA, then it's just not going to show up. And I wonder if this more, you know, if you're not so concerned about exactly what kind of life it is, I wonder if there is an opportunity. Like, would you detect those phages in passing through your nanopores?
Well, yeah, through nanopores, yes, because nanopores would be able to detect, right? That doesn't change the DNA enough to not allow it to pass through the nanopore. And yeah, the alpha is exactly built to extract these polyelectrolytes. By the way, you mentioned shadow biosphere. We had Carol Cleland, who is author of that term, here in a Foundation for Applied Molecular Evolution a couple of months ago. So I had a chance to discuss with her definition of life and how useful is definition of life for search for life in the universe. I'm quite radical on that. That it doesn't help basically at all. But that's another story.
Well, no, I'd love to hear it. So give me your position on a definition of life.
Yeah, because whichever definition we make, there are so many exceptions all the time when you are searching for something which is transitioning from not being life to being life, it's it doesn't make much sense, right? You can have a piece of RNA that replicates itself only under a very specific condition. Is it life or not? You don't know because it does not fit the description of self-sustaining system. But then many other things don't. So the idea we agreed on with Carol, and you can read more about that on our blog, Primordial Scoop. The idea is that you need to search for interesting anomalies and always define what you mean when you search for life. So our ALF actually searches for systems that are capable of replication and evolution. So that's what we are looking for. So if it's able to replicate and evolve, it must to have genetic information. So it contains life as we know it, but it might contain life as we don't know yet.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like you know when you see it, right?
Right.
I think about, like, you know, people say viruses, you know, are viruses life? And like, they're not, but they're indicative of life. Like, they're life adjacent. And so if you see them, then you know there's life.
That's my argument. Like, virologists don't need to know whether viruses are life or not to actually study them. So the same is, like, we don't need to know whether Martians are alive or not to look for them, right? You just need to make assumptions and declare what you are exactly studying.
Right. Now, this is a phase one grant, which means that you have sort of proposed the idea, and now you're going to create some kind of deliverable for NASA to then decide, hopefully, to take this on to phase two, and eventually maybe it'll be a piece of hardware that flies to Mars. So what are you hoping to deliver by the end of this study?
Right. So we hope to have a tabletop instrument that can extract genetic polymers from ice cores we have at University of Florida. We are a separate organization. We are a Foundation for Applied Molecular Evolution. And so the idea is to extract DNA from ice cores from Antarctica, which are known to have very sparse population of microbes. So if we can deliver that, that would be success. And of course, we will do some metric with a known concentration of bacteria to make calibration curves and stuff like that.
What about dead life? I mean, obviously, you know, trying to search through fossilized Martian rock, you're not going to find very much DNA. But do you think like if it's frozen in ice for long periods of time and partly degraded, do you think, you know, how far back do you think you would still be able to find some presence?
Right. So there was an article by Beidel. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. Sorry, I messed it up. But that some authors found that even in the oldest ice we have on Earth, you can still find detectable DNA and traces of metabolism. So, and that ice was 8 million years old. So imagine you have glacier at the close to the bottom of the glacier, very deep. You have pockets which contain cells, which were enclosed in that ice for 8 million years, and you can still find the DNA and analyze it and sequence it. So on Earth, we can. It's safe to say that 10 million years, it's still would be detectable if Martians have DNA. Other polyelectrolytes might be less stable, so we would detect them to shorter periods. But the thing is, if you are deep enough in ice, you are shielded from the cosmic radiation, so you should have a similar survivability for DNA as on Earth. So millions of years, it's the expected time. And that ties very well to obliquity on Mars, because Mars quite recently, on a period about 100,000 years, Mars changes its obliquity, and in which case it starts snowing in mid-latitude, and you can have those ice deposits growing. So these ice deposits, if they are less than 10 million years old, they will be sampling the entire surface of Mars, because it's ice and dust brought through the dust storm. So as we can find life delivered to Arctic ices from all over the globe, on Earth, so we assume that the similar case would be on Mars. So when you have high obliquity, you have moist and wet and a higher temperature on Mars, which would allow bacteria to proliferate on the surface and then being deposited in the ice, which we want to look for. So
That's really interesting. And I wonder how far back, like what is the oldest ice you could find on Mars? I mean, it could be tens of millions, hundreds of millions of years old. I mean, who knows when it...
It will depend how deep you will go with your rod wells for your refueling.
Right. That's really interesting. All right. Now, I want to shift gears now, because you are working on a lot of projects that are sort of in the same field. So let's talk about the Morningstar mission. And what is that?
Okay, so Morningstar mission, it's a mission to Venus. It's led by Sarah Seeger at MIT. And this mission is basically inspiration for what I'm doing now, because it's a first private interplanetary mission. So my experience from going with the private mission is that it's a much faster than going through the NASA-funded project. Because as soon as you have something working, you can go to the next step instead of writing proposals as soon as you have something done. So back to the mission. Our goal is to send a small probe on a rocket lab, Electron rocket, which will drop the probe in the atmosphere of Venus. It will fall through the cloud layer. And as it's falling down, it will shoot laser at 440 nanometers, which is green color, into the droplets and observe the reflected light, and also analyze if there is some fluorescence. So the instrument, which we will have only one instrument on board, which is called autofluorescence nephelometer, will study two things. One, from the polarization of the light and intensity, we can deduce what's the refractive index of the droplets and size and perhaps shape distribution, which can tell us something about the physical properties of the cloud. But we are also analyzing fluorescence. That's something we found in our lab, that most organics you put in a concentrated sulfuric acid are actually not destroyed. They are converted into larger molecules that are fluorescent, which is very interesting. So if we see some fluorescence in clouds of Venus, that's quite sure indication that there is organic carbon in high concentrations. And that's something I'm working on.
Right. This research, I remember this came out a couple of months ago from, I guess, the team led by Sarah Seeger, that of the 20 amino acids used by life on Earth, like 19 of them, I think, are largely unharmed by being in high concentrations of sulfuric acid, which is surprising.
Yeah. So that's something. Yeah, that research was factually correct, but that's something we have a little fights between our group, because I claim that if you have these amino acids with a mixture of other organics, they are not reacting. So when you have, for example, alanine, it's not going to react with another alanine in concentrated sulfuric acid. But if you have other molecules it can react with, it will cross-link with them and make larger molecules. So that's something. So proteins in general are very unstable in sulfuric acid. So if you have individual amino acids, it's stable. But in longer proteins, they are, because you have large mixture of different reactive molecules, they can cross-link and make basically tar. But to not put that down, just because the life as we know it is destroyed, it doesn't mean that different biochemistry cannot exist in concentrated sulfuric acid. And that's something very surprising. And to be honest, when I started working on this project, I thought that, okay, I'll just show that what they are proposing is a bad idea. But the more I work on it, the more I think that there could be something on it. There could be some organic chemistry we don't know, because very few organic chemists study chemistry in concentrated sulfuric acid. So who knows? That's why we need to do more research.
Normally you wear gloves and stay away from it, right?
Right. or just put some students on it. I'm just joking.
So that's really interesting. So what do you think is the time frame for the Morningstar mission to launch?
So the plan time frame now, we are quite sure it will fly early next year, January or February. So, and then again, to remind you about the timeline, we started working on it about 2020, and it will fly in 2025, which is very short period for a mission. When you know, the other missions to Venus, Da Vinci and
Veritas
Vision, right? They were both delayed.
Yeah, they're 2031, I think. Yeah, they're not going.
They were supposed to fly like 2027, then delay further and further.
Yeah, and the and ESA has a mission as well. They're planning. So, but they're all in the early 2030s. That's amazing that from idea to flight ready in just 5 years.
So that's a beautiful thing about the collaboration with private industry. And also, it's a small mission. It's a much lower cost than the NASA missions, but still should provide us with plenty of information we didn't get a chance to study in situ in Venus, basically since the Soviet era, right?
Right, yeah. It's too bad that this probe is just going to fall through the atmosphere one time. It would be amazing if there could be something that remained and, as you say, studied in situ for long periods of time. What about sort of bringing your ideas together? You know, if you could sit around for a while, gather more and more of this sulfuric acid, do you think, or maybe you could dilute it with water or something, do you think there's a way to kind of take some of the ideas with ALF and apply it to the Venusian atmosphere?
Yeah, I think for each problem you need a specific tool, and ALF will very likely not be adaptable to concentrated sulfuric acid. And if you had to dilute it, you would have to dilute it very substantially, which would, which might destroy the biochemistry in concentrated sulfuric acid. So that's another interesting thing, how to develop tools to analyze concentrated sulfuric acid or the organics in concentrated sulfuric acid. So far we have NMR, and that's about it, because the concentrated sulfuric acid is destroying the instrument you want to use to analyze your samples. So nobody wants to put concentrated sulfuric acid in a mass spec, right, in any substantial amounts.
Yeah, the old problem with Venus, that it's just, it's trying to destroy anything you send to study it. It's a problem. But you're not done yet. You've got another mission that you are, you have some news about as well.
Right. So that mission is called IMPRESS. It's an International Mars Penetrator Ride Share System. Again, very nice acronym to get people excited about the mission. And the idea is, yet again, we need to find if there's active biosphere on Mars before we send humans there and study it. It's clear to community. I'm not, or we are not first to say this. There has been a large push towards this, but yet still, in the latest decadal survey, NASA or Academy of Sciences found that NASA does not have a planetary protection plan on timescales consistent with earliest plausible human missions to Mars, which means that, well, in other words, none of the missions we have on Mars or plan to send on Mars before plausible human presence could find life on Mars or further study it. So we already work with ALF, which is the agnostic life finder, but I feel that search for life on Mars should be like a global effort. And so inspired by the private mission we are sending to Venus, and thanks to the modern space, flight to Mars is not that expensive. So if we hire buy Falcon Heavy, which has a capacity about 17 metric tons to be delivered to Mars, for 100 million, we can deliver that payload. The problem with delivering stuff to Mars, it's mostly on the descent and soft landing. But if you design a mission which contains only hard landers, which is like planetary penetrators or probes, which basically just impact the surface, you don't have to worry about deploying the space crane and parachutes and all those complex systems. And if you send thousands of these, half of them fail, you still have a couple of thousands of probes with many different instruments. And getting to the cost, per kilogram, it's about $10,000 of scientific payload you can deliver to Mars, which is affordable for any garage scientists, right? Like, I can decide whether to send a Deep Space 2 mission type probe to Mars or remodel my kitchen. So, and so the idea is to engage everybody all over the world, first student competition, to propose these probes. Many planetary penetrators were already developed, some were already flown to Mars, but because they are small probes, they usually don't fill the entire payload. So they are being add-ons to other missions. And so many laboratories or teams have these already. We can fly them, but we just need to fly them with somebody. So instead of flying them with somebody, we can just ride share everybody and send it off to Mars.
Ride share 1,000 probes to go to Mars.
Yeah, ride share. Deploy from orbit thousands of planetary penetrators, a swarm, right, which will communicate and send the results back. And because they are so cheap, you don't have to use the approach that NASA uses, which is failure is not an option. You have to use instruments that were shown to work, but those instruments might not be as innovative when looking for life as we don't know it. So I think we need to engage all brains in the world to actually study the entire Mars. So that's one way how to do it.
That's really interesting. How big is it, like a planetary penetrator? How big is one of these things?
It depends. So in the range, what has been sent to Mars? So we had Deep Space 2 sent in 98 or 99, which is about 2.5 kilograms, about this big. The penetrator was very small, and it was designed to penetrate about half a meter below the ground. Then Russians in 96 sent a mission which was called Mars 96, and those penetrators were, I think, about 2 meters, something like that, and they were designed to penetrate about 5 meters deep. They leave antenna behind them to transmit the signal back to the orbiter and analyze the subsurface. And because we assume that life on Mars will be hiding below the surface because the surface is irradiated by hard UV and bombarded by particle radiation, that's where you want to go. So instead of slowly landing and then start drilling, which are both hard processes, you can just combine it and penetrate.
Right. And so it, like the front, the impactor has some kind of, I don't know, like it crashes like the front of a car, that it sort of absorbs the impact. A crumple zone on the front of your impactor, and then it.
So that's another type of it's not the penetrator. JPL developed a shield concept. I forgot what the acronym is for, but it has a honeycomb structure which crumples as it runs. So it will have some 5,000 Gs upon impact, but will stay as a flat disk on the surface after the crash zone is crashed. But those planetary penetrators which were flown, the Deep Space 2 and Mars 96, they didn't have any crumple zone. They break in the Martian regolith. So going straight down.
I don't remember Deep Space 2. I remember Deep Space 1, but I don't remember Deep Space 2.
There you go. That's an interesting mission. It actually
did it survive?
No, it did not survive. It did not survive because the battery ran out before. So
they were expected to survive an 80,000 G impact. Yeah.
Yep.
But it's interesting. Like, I think, you know, a lot has been learned now about operating in the Martian atmosphere thanks to, say, the Ingenuity helicopter. And I wouldn't be surprised if you could get those Gs down significantly now, understanding a lot more about how the atmosphere works and different ideas. And so with crumple zones and
for some instruments, you don't need to. Some instruments can survive 80,000 Gs.
Yeah.
Some instruments would prefer lower G load. And then you can design your probe. If you make a long rod that penetrates deeper, it has a longer distance to break. So the G load is much, much less than that. So actually going deeper, of course, going slower is the best solution. But then you waste your payload on a parachute and stuff like that. But that's a compromise. The idea behind the IMPRESS mission, which I call for help with the mission design, is to have a different kind of penetrators riding in a swarm. So there will be different shapes, different designs, and you just deploy them from orbit.
Oh, I really like that. You're talking about Mars as a place to search for life, but I think a lot of people are most excited about Enceladus, Europa, places where we know there's large amounts of liquid water in the case of Enceladus actually being thrown into space. You must think about how you could detect life there. What ideas have come to mind for that?
Right. No, I'm excited about those moons as well. As you pointed out, they have the subsurface oceans. So there's quite high chance that some sort of life is there. So I just returned from a UPSYCHON, which is astrobiological mission, astrobiological conference, which was in Providence now. And so, yes, many talks were dedicated to these missions to Enceladus and to Europa. And there were different kinds of submarines analyzing the plumes. Right, so the same set of instruments, basically. You want to study the organics. You want to make sure that you are not detecting the false positive results. Yeah, but what I'm highlighting always with the organization I started, the Alpha Mars, is that Mars is the only astrobiological target that will be affected by human presence in a decade. So if we wait a couple decades to study Enceladus, if we have to make a trade-off, then nothing much will happen and we will have better instrumentation. If we wait a couple decades to study Mars, we will have humans on Mars. So, you know, there are some concerns. It's going to be harder to find the extant life. And yeah, planetary protection, it's something that
still bullets. I mean, it's a big problem. And if we do find life on Mars, and we know that human bacteria has a way of getting everywhere, it really is just a matter of time before our bacteria, you know, tries to exploit the various niches that it finds on Mars. And I know that there have been experiments on the International Space Station that have shown that there are certain kinds of life cyanobacteria, things like that, that are ready to go for Mars. Like, just send them in. They can't wait. Do you think that we stand a chance of keeping Mars as a pristine environment with humans living there?
No, I don't think that we will keep Mars pristine. I don't think that Mars is pristine anymore because we sent quite a lot of probes there. But it's a not yes-no question. It's on a degree of how much bioload you are sending in. So although the bacteria can survive on Mars for a longer time, as we know from those experiments on ISS you mentioned, we are not sure if bacteria can reproduce on Mars. So I'm not as much concerned about the harm we can cause to Mars environment. I'm more concerned about it's going to be harder to determine, harder to look for Martian life if you have contamination from Earth like on Mars, right? If we can do the metagenomics on Mars, then you can distinguish it, but it's just harder. So I don't think that we should postpone humans going to Mars. And once we are on Mars, there will be a lot of bioload going back and forth. But I think that we definitely need to focus on a search for life on Mars before we send humans there.
I wonder if we do find life on Mars, that would dramatically change the way we would explore Mars. It would be very much about trying to turn our settlements into a clean room on another world and trying to figure out a way to explore without continuing to contaminate it.
I don't think that it's right. So, okay, first thing, we have two options. We can either say that we don't want to find life on Mars, or it's like, I don't want to know. I'm just going right there without knowing. That's
right. A million people, let's go. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm for it. Let's go. But, you know, if we have some time, let's try to at least try. And yes, once we have humans there, I don't think you can make a clean room because the procedures of keeping, right, you can limit the exposure of Mars surface to human bacteria or Earth stowaway bacteria, but you cannot eliminate it because you cannot sterilize humans in a autoclave, right?
Right. Yeah. It is too bad. It does feel like we'll get to this point and we will have to decide, do we want to live on Mars or do we want to leave Mars as a wilderness and essentially contaminate the secrets that it can tell us about the formation of life on another world. I mean, I know it's weird. It's like if we're lucky, we find no life, And then it's just another place we can go and inhabit, and who cares? It's just rocks and dirt. But if there is life there, that's a problem.
Both answers to the question, is there life on Mars, would be great news. Like, if Mars is completely sterile on the surface, then yeah, it's an open playground. And we can treat it just as we do with Moon, right? Run the industry as we wish. And if the if there's life on Mars, we can learn much from it. I think the advances in medicine we can have from studying completely different life forms, that would be great.
I mean, what do you think about this idea that you know, we only know of life forming here on Earth, and yet if we do see life on Mars, then either they're connected somehow through panspermia, or it's an independent life forming event. And if it is, then there really should be life everywhere in the universe. We don't see it.
Yep. No, that's an interesting question. I want to know.
I mean, I think that would be the first question. Like, if we did find life on Mars, like, the very first question would be, are we related? Is there a common ancestor? When did we separate? And if it's and so it would be even more exciting to find life that was completely different from the way life works on Earth. And there is no common ancestor, that life found a totally different way to form.
Yeah, well, that would be great. But because I'm quite a strong believer in panspermia, especially during the early stages of solar system development, when we had like 4 billion years ago, or 3.5 billion years ago, when we had both Earth and Mars looking very similar, with a humid surface, with lakes on the surface, and you had frequent exchange of material through impact ejecta. Actually, I have a impact ejecta over here. This is a Martian meteorite, a tiny piece. So we know that there is exchange happening until today, and we know that some of these rocks coming from Mars or from Earth to Mars would, if they contained life, bacteria as we know it, it would survive the travel. And then if they hit warm little ponds, they could proliferate in there. So I think that there's quite high chance of a similar origin. But still, then there could have been a couple billion years of separate evolution, which can give us. But still, you know, it's still hypothesis. I still want to know.
Yeah. Well, and then you look at extra, you know, interstellar objects, Oumuamua and Borisov, and things that are traveling from star to star, and you can imagine these various mechanisms where chunks could be blasted off of Mars and went interstellar and have been drifting. And so, like, if we do find life, is all life in the galaxy connected somehow?
Right. If you combine it with the knowledge that the oldest life on Earth can survive a couple of million years embedded deep in ice without any source of energy, and especially if you freeze bacteria completely, there's no liquid water, you completely still metabolism, then they can survive for a million years for sure. So if you can transfer from solar system to solar system within 1 million years or so, and you are in deep enough, big enough chunk of meteorite to not be irradiated by cosmic radiation, then interstellar panspermia is also possible. So
I have so many questions. And it's not like you have the answers. I mean, you know, we have the same questions, and it's just the only way is to just keep picking away with the sources of evidence that we have. Jan, what are you obsessed with right now?
Well, now it's the work that's been for a while. The project Alpha Mars we started, now it's growing. Alpha Mars, it's a agnostic life-finding association. It's an international team of astrobiologists with the same goal to look for life on Mars before we send humans there. So that's what I'm dedicating most of my time on. Then I'm also still working on the Venus mission. Now we are preparing an article where I'm stating that basically the droplets forming Venus clouds are as dark as if you collected them in a larger volume. It would be as dark visually as a human blood, for example. Very surprising, but that's another thing.
That's really interesting.
What else? Yeah, now I'm trying the Impress mission, and I got two rescue dogs on top of that and a new house. So now I'm obsessed about sleeping, right?
Yes.
Because I don't have enough for that.
I know the feeling. Well, Jan, it's an absolute pleasure to talk with you. Good luck with all of these projects. And I hope to interview you when you shift to phase two and maybe phase three. So thanks for taking the time to chat with me today.
Yeah, thank you, Fraser. And I want to make a shout out. If you want to help with any of those projects, go to alphamars.org and you can send us a message. Or I will be answering comments in below the video.
Oh, that sounds great. Awesome. All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Jan Szwajcek. Really interesting. And I really want to sort of stress how interested he is in having both the general public and other people who are in the astrobiology community get involved in some of these projects. If any of the things that we talked about sort of struck a note with you, go to the website. He's the founder of the Agnostic Life Finding Association. The website is alphamars.org, and you can go there and you can see the various projects and get involved in some of them. Now, I'm going to talk some more about sort of my thoughts and feedback on this interview that I just did. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. A special thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew Gross, Dennis Alberti, Dougie Stewart, Dustin Cable, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Mark Anastas, Modso, Paul Rohrbach, Stephen Krasaki, Stephen Fowler Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our other supporters on Patreon. I'm not going to lie, I feel a little bit of anxiety about what is going to happen with the search for life on Mars. Like, on the one hand, you've got people who are wanting to send humans to Mars to explore, to maybe live. You've got not only the plans that SpaceX is going to do, but NASA is working on its own plans. And you've got the Chinese Space Agency working on their plans. Probably by the 2040s, we're going to see humans set foot on the surface of Mars. And when we do, when those first humans walk around on Mars, we are going to be beginning this process of potentially contaminating whatever life is already existent on Mars. And I'm all for exploration. I'm all for sending humans to other worlds. And at the same time, this question of, are we alone in the universe? Did life form on Mars? Is a really important question. And the longer we live on Mars, the harder it's going to be to get at that answer. And we might lose that answer entirely. And yet, if we could discover another kind of life, either that we do share a common ancestor or we don't, and life just formed completely on its own in some other environment, that would be amazing. And so it is a really tricky problem and requires a lot of analysis, requires a lot of thinking and care. And I don't think that there's, you know, a lot of people on the space exploration side of things or the let's colonize Mars side of things who are interested in going as slow as it's going to take to potentially get those answers. And yet, it is one of the most profound questions that we ask, one of the most profound answers that we could find. So I am ambivalent. And, you know, I always enjoy being ambivalent. All right. I hope you enjoyed this interview, and we'll see you next time.